In the evening.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And Kevin Dahlgren joins me now, who's an activist and a drug counselor, and he's usually right in the thick of it when it comes to the homeless population here in the Northwest. Kevin, welcome back.
Lars, thanks for having me on again.
I'm just curious, you've actually found some of the homeless guys who've taken to the water, although it's not going to be the first time, because there's been a phenomena for a while that people have figured out that if they're homeless and they can get their hands on a boat that actually floats, they can anchor it out in the channel. But your case, the one you took a look at and one you documented, was a bit different. Would you mind describing it for my audience?
Yeah, this is more unique because this was hand-built by a homeless guy. It's on the Columbia River. He's called it the Mark Twain. He's been there for over 5 years without anybody bothering him. And he's just sort of, at this point, realized that he could pretty much just get away with this, and he's decided to live on there the rest of his life because it seems like the authorities will do nothing about it. And this is very obviously hand-built, right? This isn't just an ugly boat, right? And while I admire the craftsmanship in some ways that he was able to do this, I'm frustrated that, you know, the homeless continuously get away with almost everything because they're treated like a protected class. They can build what they want, do what they want, never have to pay for anything, and obviously no consequences anytime they break the law.
Well, and in fact, I was telling my producer, Tina and I used to live on the sailboat that we owned, and it was a great way to live, but we tied up at a regular moorage, and we paid the moorage fee. But we knew that the law said that if we anchored outside the channel, and the channel is pretty well marked for where the big deep draft ships have to go, you can stay tied up there indefinitely. Now, it might get a little tough in December and January when the weather is less than favorable and it'd be tough to get to shore and back. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the only other question might be human waste. And I don't want to get too graphic. We are a family show and it is lunchtime. But have they answered how they're dealing with that problem?
Well, they're surrounded by water. Does that answer it?
Well, it does and it doesn't because... And that's where the law gets a little weird. You want to know the peculiarities of the law? And it's actually, I think, it might even be viewed as sexually discriminatory. If a guy is out fishing and has had a few soda pops or beers or whatever, he can stand up and let water fly. What he can't do is the other one. And if you dump the other one in the water, which usually involves dumping it, and there's the bizarre thing. If you dump it in a container first and then dump the container, you're violating the rules. But if you can somehow manage to engineer getting rid of it, most guys who've gone fishing and might have a little bit too much coffee or soda pop or beer or whatever, know how to get rid of that, you just stand up and do it. And so the one you can get rid of, but disposing of human waste in the river where people swim and where people boat and everything else, there's a point where the Coast Guard will come after you. And I'm kind of curious about that, if the Coast Guard has had anything to say to this guy.
According to him, no. He said on very rare occasions he's been greeted by like the fire department that monitors the waterways, but not in any sort of negative way. Mostly they just said hi. But, you know, it's important to remember he also has a girlfriend living on there, not to mention all the homeless who live around there. So he times that by several years. That's a heck of a lot of waste in our waterways.
Yeah, it's an awful lot. And not to mention garbage and things like that. Now, I would suppose the responsible person would occasionally sail the boat to shore, you know, to a dock somewhere, like a public dock, and get rid of ordinary garbage. But then again, it might be tempting just to throw it in the water as well. So you've got issues like that. You think this is going to become a bigger phenomenon this summer as the weather has turned good?
I think so, because there's actually three I know of right now on the Willamette River. So there's, it's sort of this new thing I'm seeing where the homeless are now just either buying really old boats and just living on them or building their own. And you're seeing them like kind of all over. And I know of about three or four that are being hand built right now. So this is kind of an issue. It's hopefully it doesn't explode. And I appreciate you having me on to kind of raise awareness on this, that the last thing we want, it's bad enough it's on our sidewalks and in our public, our green spaces, but the last thing we place we want them now is in our waterways.
Well, and in fact, Kevin, it gets to a more of a philosophical point, but if you're capable of building a boat and then keeping the boat afloat and then managing all the things you have to manage to get food to and from the boat, waste, whether it's garbage or other things to and from the boat, it sounds like you have all the capabilities to hold a job. And yet these people are not holding jobs. They're not contributing to the society, but they're going to draw on the society. If somebody falls overboard, I'm sure that the River Patrol and everybody else is going to show up to help them. If they have a medical emergency, they'll show up to help. But they're basically, as far as I'm concerned, Kevin, they're leeches on society. They said, I'm going to live here. I get all the benefits of living here. I may even access the social welfare benefits, but I'm not going to contribute at all.
Well, you make an excellent point, too, is they need emergency services sometimes, but are they paying into the emergency services? The answer is absolutely no. And you times that by hundreds and thousands. Definitely, there's no other way to describe it than being a leech. I'm a big believer in helping a person reach their fullest potential, becoming self-sufficient, which also means being a contributing member of society. Which,
no, and in this case,
definitely not.
No, they're not. And Kevin, this year marks 45 years. May was the month, and I forgot to bring it up in May, but I was a brand new reporter in town in the Portland Metro, and I went to a press conference where Multnomah County announced its 10-year program to end homelessness, May of 1985. Yeah. It is now July, or almost July, of late June of 2025, 45 years later, and the problem is worse, not better. And I just wonder when the folks in Seattle, in King County, and in Portland and Multnomah County are going to get the idea the more you spend on this problem, the more of it you get.
Yeah, I've always said this. If money were the solution, we would have solved it by now, right? So that's always the red flag. When a politician asks for more money for homelessness, they either don't understand the problem or they understand it all too well and they're trying to benefit from it. Either way, money doesn't solve the problem.
No, and Kevin, I would think that government would apply the same rule that you and I would apply to something. If my car needs a repair, I take it to a shop. They repair it. If they say it's repaired and it's not, I take it back and say, keep working on it till you're done. I've already paid for the repair, but you didn't repair it. If somebody has a job that they're doing at your home, putting on a new roof or pouring a sidewalk or whatever they're going to do, you're free to say, until you're done with the job, you don't get paid. And yet government has been shoveling out literally hundreds of millions of dollars in the Puget Sound region, hundreds of millions of dollars in the Tri-County Portland region, and they don't have any, I guess, any criteria for saying, have you actually solved any part of the problem? Are you being effective with all this money we're giving you?
They have not. There is no measurable results, no metrics.
That is Kevin Dahlgren. You find his reporting not just on this show, but also on social media. Back in a moment. It's a Monday, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I mentioned this new NPR report that says that parents around America are now saying one child is enough, and they blame the economy. Well, is it economic pressure or a cultural shift that's reshaping parenthood in America. Anthony LaBruna joins me now, who's executive director at the American Principles Project. Anthony, welcome back to the program.
Lars, always great being with you.
So I thank you for that, but why would American parents be going this direction? Is it really just about money or something else?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, right? You know, I'm a young man. I just got married myself. You know, under the Biden administration, there's no way I'd want to have a big family. The economic pressures they put on young people who want to start families was atrocious. And I think this administration has whittled away at some of the economic concerns for young people looking to have families, but it's just not enough. You know, Jim Banks did a great job on providing or bringing down the child tax credit, but there's more that needs to be done there. But also, we're also talking about a huge social issue where it's cool to be, you know, single parent or parents or individuals without kids. It's a huge trend online.
Dinks.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to be one, but, you know, a couple of years back under Biden, it makes sense to be one because there's no tenable way for young people my age to want to go pursue 5 or 6 child families. It just is almost impossible. So it's a mix of both. And I think what you're focusing on the social side is the push from academia to have this ideology and thought process of that the family is not a good core unit to be at our country's center.
Well, Anthony, let me ask you something. From a distance, I still remember, I mean, I've been around long enough, I remember when China imposed the one child, and that was imposed on the population. And I think all of us said, well, completely crazy. That's not going to work out well. What's it going to be like in 20 or 30 years when you have an entire country with an overload of young men and not very many young women? And what does it mean demographically? And now China sounds like it's in a demographic death spiral. I don't want America to end up like that. I also don't want the government to either mandate kids or mandate no kids. And the most attractive idea I've seen, you know, since I'm not in the childbearing years anymore, but if you there was a country that I read about a couple of years ago, and it's the memory is foggy. But what they did was they said, when you have a kid, we'll forgive you of a quarter of your income taxes. So it benefited people who are both working at a job and having children, which I think is two positive things. And they say, well, what about the welfare state? And I said, well, if you're working at a job and you're concerned about your income taxes, you're probably not on welfare. You're out working a job. And now you've got an incentive maybe to have a couple of kids or 3 kids and get rid of 3/4 of your income taxes and benefit the country at the same time. I don't know what the economists would say about it, but that seemed like a sensible way to do it. As opposed to the Lyndon Johnson special where you say, oh, you're having a kid, you're pregnant. Good. Don't get married. Don't have a boyfriend. Don't have anybody else to help you raise that child. And if you don't, we'll send you a check. We'll reward you for putting that child in a very tenuous situation and for you staying in a tenuous situation. That seemed like one of the exactly wrong things to do. So with all my crazy thoughts out there, Anthony, where should we go to change this? And is it the job or the duty of government to try to modify this point of view?
Well, look, I think you hit the nail right on the head there. You know, the left incentivizes to put single parenthood and put children in these difficult situations. I think the countries you're referring to are Hungary and Poland. They have some very interesting ways of pushing people in their countries to have big families. The more kids you have, the less income tax. And when you hit, I believe, a certain number, I believe it's 3 or 4, you don't pay income tax at all anymore, right? So I think it's a combination. I think we have to have a huge cultural switch, you know, and I think that's happening right now. You know, as a young person, I see it day in day. Like, I have 6 staffers. They all have babies on the way, including Terry Schilling, who our president, you know, he's on his 8th. But we have all these young men in my office who have all recently got married within the last 2 years, and they're all having their first kid, and that's amazing. So I think culturally we're coming back to reality, and you see these young men and women who've got married and want to have families. I think where the government comes in is important because they can't be too heavy-handed. They can't be too lightly-handed. we need a perfect balance, right? I would love to see something either proposed by Congress or pushed by this administration. I know, you know, APP is looking for that next avenue, what we do on this issue. But I'd love to see something along the lines of Congress reducing income taxes for working Americans who do have families over, you know, 4 or 5 kids to help with that population and keeping our population growing.
Even if you only got to four, Anthony, wouldn't the demographics of that work out well? Because as I understand it, Americans right now, native-born Americans especially, are having kids at less than replacement level. So if you got the average family saying, well, we're going to have 3, maybe 4, because that forgives all the income taxes, it probably pencils out as well because the country is effectively investing in the future. We give a tremendous benefit to people who buy a house. I own a house. So do I write off the mortgage interest on the house? Absolutely I do. And why? Because the country, both state and federal governments, have said it's desirable to have people own their own homes. So we're going to give you an incentive to do that. You want to just rent and be transient? Nah, you're not going to get a write-off for that. And people might say that's unfair. I might even agree with them philosophically, but as long as it's there, I'm going to take it. If all of a sudden you started saying, hey, have a kid, 25% of your federal tax liability goes away. Have two, then 50. Then 3 and 75, and when you get to 4, no federal income taxes at all. And if you did it that way, like you said, Poland is doing it, wouldn't that have the prospect of virtually doubling the reproduction rate of average Americans?
100%. You'd see people searching out that lifestyle, having big families, mothers returning to the home, being able to be the main provider at home, but also too, it addresses our national security concerns with the lack of our reproducing of our population. It addresses those issues, and I think that's a major issue that kind of gets glanced over just for the replacement. You know, us not having kids, us not having big, strong families leads to a weaker America and weaker national security on the world stage.
Yeah, and it also answers this stupid issue where people are saying, well, we don't have enough people to do the jobs. We've got 10,000 boomers retiring every day. I said, yeah, and you've got about 11,000 kids graduating from high school every day, if you want to look at it on a day-to-day basis. And I said, plus, you've got another 1 million immigrants coming into the country every year legally. We don't need any illegal entry to the country to fulfill that need if we're already basically replacing all the boomers with the high school graduates. That's Anthony LaBruna. Anthony, thanks very much. He is executive director at the American Principles Project. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's always right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line. We've always done it. We always will.
The Lars Larson Show. Some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. One of the things I've suggested to you is that when Donald Trump began the massive deportation of illegal aliens, there would be a number of positive effects. One of them, I think, immediately is going to be housing. We've already seen reports that about 1 million people have self-deported from the United States. They saw the writing on the wall and they said, it's time to get out while the getting is good. Second effect, though, is about jobs. Because I know the standard language from people who support illegal aliens being used much the way the Democrat Party used slaves back before the Civil War. They say, well, we couldn't do this without this because there are all these jobs that Americans won't do, which I think is a provably false statement. But are we already starting to see the effect on paychecks in America because of illegal aliens leaving the country? Dr. Stephen Camerota joins me now, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. We consult with CIS all the time because they've got the numbers. So, Dr. Camerota, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Did CIS just do a study about what the effect is of self-deportation on the job prospects and paycheck prospects of Americans?
Well, what we did was we looked at the monthly household survey first to try to figure out, are illegal immigrants leaving?
Okay, stop for a second, Dr. Camerota.
Yeah, sure.
I want people to understand, what is the household survey? I know what it is, but I want my audience to know what the household survey is.
Yeah, so the household survey is a survey collected by the Census Bureau for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's where we get the unemployment numbers and things like that. We get wage data from it. We get labor force participation and all things associated with the labor force. But they do survey the total population. So it does give us a pretty good picture of what's going on. And since over 30 years now, they've been asking, you know, where were you born? Are you a U.S. citizen? When did you come to the United States? They even ask where your parents are born. And without a long discussion, that is pretty good. It's not perfect. There are issues, but it looks like it does a pretty good job of capturing illegal immigrants even. The Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics are clear on that. They do capture. The survey is designed to capture them. Now, some are missed, and there's a debate about how many are missed. But let me just give you an example. We've done a detailed analysis of the January data, and it's clear that there are more than 15 million illegal immigrants in that data. Now, there may be more missed, and I think there are, but that gives you an idea that the survey is really quite good and does pick up illegal immigrants.
Okay, and some of that survey is done literally by phone, isn't it? Don't they call households and say, we're doing a survey
for
this?
But every...
Go ahead.
Yes, but originally, pretty much everyone in the survey gets an in-person interview, gets a visit from an employee from the government beforehand. And so that is generally thought to improve the quality. There are other things they do. They have a lot of foreign language speakers there who assure people that, you know, it'll be anonymous, so they won't share the information. So that works. And people are in the survey for several months. They then leave it for a while, but then they come back and do it again. And this creates even more rapport in a relationship with the survey takers.
Because,
so there are things they do to... Oh, go ahead.
Because they could say, are there members of your household who are seeking a job and don't have one? And they could say, oh, no, everybody in the family is employed. Or, no, half the family is unemployed and half the family is employed. When you check in a month or a couple of months, you say, okay, you were here, you know, 3 months ago. Where are you now? And they say, oh, well, two of the people looking for jobs have now found jobs. You get that kind of information, right?
Yes, you get all that kind of information and other things, like I said, like, are you a U.S. citizen? When did you come to America? You know, where were your parents born? Where were you born? So there's a lot of great information in this data. And I would argue, as a person who's been analyzing it for the last 35 years or so, it's just a national treasure. We can just do so much with it. Again, not perfect, but it does show an enormous number of illegal immigrants in it. So we can use it to kind of gauge what's going on with some caveats.
And by the way, a couple of the numbers that jumped out at me. One of them was the number of foreign-born individuals in the labor force. So just the number. So you could be foreign-born and you are now a citizen. You could be foreign-born and now you're a green card holder. You could be foreign-born and you're an illegal alien. So it includes all of those groups and more I probably haven't named. How did that change between January and May?
Yeah, so the information shows a decline of 600,000 in the survey from January to May of the entire foreign-born population.
That's huge, isn't it, statistically?
Yeah, it is. It is big. And, in fact, the overall foreign-born was down a little less than a million. So, again, some pretty big declines in just a few months, four-month period.
Have we seen numbers change like that before in other circumstances? I mean, I don't want to hear, well, you know, this happens every spring or this happens in late winter every year. But in this case, do we know whether this is dramatically different from other times in America in say, the last 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, we have seen a few big changes of this size before. Very rare, but it's unusual. We'd normally expect to see, in terms of people exiting the labor force, we'd only see this after a severe economic downturn.
Like 08.
We've had some changes. There is fluctuation. But here's the bottom line. When we zero in, if you want to know about illegal immigrants, on non-citizens, and specifically from Latin America, who responded that they came to America in 1980 or later. I could explain why, but that population of non-citizens from Latin America who came in 1980 or later in the data is very highly correlated with the illegal immigrants. And when we look at that data, it declined by about 1.1 million since January. So all of the fall off in the foreign born is among these more recently arrived Latin Americans who are not citizens. In fact, if we go back to December, it's down by like 1.5 million. So the month after Donald Trump was elected. So big changes are precisely among the population of people who were pretty sure, well, who correlate highly with the illegal immigrants. And if we burrow even deeper in the data and begin to try to estimate how many legal and illegal immigrants, again, it shows the same thing, about a million decline in the illegal population since January. And we've never seen anything like that before.
Do you see anything that you could actually point to in the data about how that's affecting the paychecks of the people who are still here?
Well, we've had a recent rise of about 2% for like non-college educated Americans in wages. Now, it's not a huge change, and you always have to be careful about, you know, confusing, thinking something's a trend. But boy, that is exactly consistent with what we would expect. Because remember, there are highly skilled illegal immigrants, but overwhelmingly, there are people actually who don't have any education beyond high school. And they're very heavily concentrated where you might guess in construction and, retail and building, cleaning and maintenance, those kinds of occupations. And it does look like wages have gone up there. I mean, there's a lot of demand for those kind of jobs. So it's always hard to say that the departure of illegal immigrants, caused this, but it's very consistent with that possibility.
Absolutely. Dr. Camerota, thank you very much. That's Dr. Stephen Camerota, the Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. We're always glad to check in with them. So when your friends say, well, what do you think about getting rid of all these illegal aliens? Well, I'll tell you what. I would look forward to millions of housing units being freed up, not this year, but in the next couple of years. We're going to see if you could see the exit of, say, 5 million people, and then they're not occupying those houses and apartments anymore. They're not occupying those jobs anymore. Their kids are not in your schools with your kids anymore. That is a bonus to the United States solely coming from the policies of the Trump administration. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, I've been there.
Council.
Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters. At least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You probably heard about some of the job cuts by Amazon, about 30,000 in total, about 14,000 of those in the white-collar end of the business. And it makes you wonder, how many jobs are going to be eliminated by the application of artificial intelligence, and how many jobs simply won't come into existence at all? Daniel Cochran joins me now, who's a senior research associate at the Heritage Foundation Center for Technology. Daniel, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I guess we have to worry about both the jobs that will be eliminated by the application of AI and the jobs that will just never come into existence that might have happened if it weren't for the availability of AI. Can you help my audience and me too understand how that's going to happen and what kind of job loss we're looking at?
Yeah, AI, as we've learned, is a disruptive technology. And in the short to medium period, what we're going to see is that it will reduce demand for humans in kind of two categories of jobs. Jobs that are we'll say low paying, but that require just kind of very routine tasks in a factory-like setting. So you think about what Amazon's doing, automating a lot of their warehouses further. That's been in the process for years. But at the same time, just after Amazon, UPS and several other companies basically announced that they plan to cut thousands of additional jobs higher up the chain. So a lot of these are like corporate, then mid-level managers, places like accounting, for example. And it turns out that a lot of those jobs can be done more effectively, or at least companies are betting that they can be done more effectively in the short run by large language models. So that's kind of where you're going to see the most disruption. And initially, it's going to be concentrated within the largest companies. Like, so that's why, like, you're seeing Amazon announce, you're seeing UPS announce, you're seeing, like, a lot of consulting firms announce they're cutting consulting jobs, relying a lot more on AI, because a lot of those jobs are highly quantitative, and they can be done by LLMs. So it's going to be a very interesting mix. But the thing that your listeners should know is what new jobs are going to be created, right? We don't know entirely, but there's going to be a new service industry, probably around like the creation of robotic machinery in these factories. You know, just like when we had the internet, you had all these companies that were creating, as an example, routers to allow you to connect to the internet. The same sort of scenarios going on here. You're going to have technicians that are going to work on the robots, and whole companies that will be required to maintain the robots and some of the automated machinery. Higher up the chain, we'll see. But I think what we need to do is focus on the skills that can't be automated. Virtue, leadership, good communication, good judgment. Those things can never be entirely replaced by AI, and those will always be in demand.
Okay, one of the things I wonder about, because everybody imagines robots doing the humans' jobs, but I wonder jobs like, say, scheduling things. I've met people over the years who've been, say, I'm a project planner. You know, somebody who works at a company that does, say, construction work, and this is the person who sort of works out the workflow. When do we need the folks to come in and excavate a site? When do we need the foundation poured? When does the concrete have to arrive? When does the steel have to arrive? These are human beings right now, but those are the kinds of jobs that might be done by an AI.
I think a lot of the administrative work, especially around scheduling, logistics, where there are kind of objective factors, outputs and inputs, I think a lot of that in the medium term will be automated. But the question is going to be whether AI is used to augment human labor or replace it altogether. So, for example, you saw when a lot of banks moved towards automated telling machines, the humans that used to do what those machines did, they weren't fired. They instead were essentially repurposed by the banks to get into relationship management, right? So they they were basically in charge of building relationships with clients. And so the question is, are firms going to take a similar approach here, thinking long term about upskilling their workers, or is it just going to be about short term cost cutting? Because if enough big companies make it just about short term cost cutting, it's going to really damage the American middle class. And that's kind of what keeps me up at night.
Okay, and Daniel, feel free to correct me if I've remembered this wrong, but I remember that Barack Obama made the comment at one point saying, well, when ATMs came along, which had apparently come along about 20 years before he made mention of it, he said they eliminated all these jobs. And some researcher, I don't think it was you, but it was another researcher, went out and said, I wonder if that actually happened. And he found exactly what you suggested. And that was that when you eliminated an awful lot of, say, you know, walking into the bank, making a deposit or taking money out, when that all went to the ATM, the automated teller machine, it didn't eliminate the teller person. It just changed what they were doing to something more valuable to the bank. And he actually found that the number of jobs at banks actually went up after ATMs, not down, as apparently nitwits and Barack Obama suspected. Did I remember that one right?
Well, you're right. And Barack Obama also said, well, if you want to really succeed, learn to code. And now coding jobs are also being automated. So the key takeaway, I think you're right, is the sort of short-termism that tends to dominate corporate America and government and big education tends to focus on specific tasks, learning to do specific tasks. We need a system that focuses on training for virtue and character, right? Because what you're going to need with all these AI systems, like think about medicine, for example, right? So aside from the doctors, right, the nurses and the technicians, someone's going to have to be looking over the AI, right? And you're going to still want humans interacting with other humans. Like, we're not going to send a robot in to take care of grandma. I mean, if we're doing that, I think we're kind of depraved as a society. We don't want that kind of future. So you need people who with good judgment, virtue, and good communication skills. And that's exactly what kids are not learning today in high school and college.
I think you're right. That's Daniel Cochran, who's a senior research associate at the Heritage Foundation Center for Technology. Daniel, thanks very much.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. And then again, you've got our X-Bowl question today. I decided to make it a bit challenging. It has to do with Ghislaine Maxwell. She is the convicted human trafficker who created the opportunity for the late Jeffrey Epstein, who either killed himself or got murdered, depending on your point of view. He had been convicted previously of using girls for sex, and Ghislaine Maxwell was involved in creating that opportunity, in providing his victims to him. He was on his way to being convicted, I think, a second time when he died in custody, a bit mysteriously, and I think not by suicide, but probably by murder. Well, now you've got Ghislaine Maxwell, who's talking to the Congress and saying that she has information that they might want to hear. So I think it's very clear that what she's seeking, or lawyers are asking the Supreme Court to throw out her conviction altogether. But so she may run the clock out there. But she's also apparently seeking a presidential pardon. Now, President Trump and Ghislaine Maxwell had in the past been at least acquaintances, if not friends. Would you trade a Ghislaine Maxwell pardon to her for prosecuting the perverts she identifies? And I explained to you that, you know, we certainly see lots of cases where people get a lesser sentence in exchange for testifying against a bigger fish that the prosecutor may be pursuing. I thought I'd put that first to our friend Josh Marquis, the former district attorney. Hey, Josh, before I get to another subject I want to throw at you at the last minute, tell me what you make of this. If Ghislaine Maxwell could actually identify, let's say, five people who were provided with children for sexual purposes, truly evil stuff, who are still out there running around loose and unindicted, unconvicted, if she can provide the information that brings about their indictments, would that be enough to grant her a pardon?
It should not. Absolutely not. She was one of the primary movers. And clearly, as you said in your intro, it's very unclear as to whether Jeffrey Epstein was murdered by whoever or committed suicide. But nonetheless, Maxwell was in on this. She was, you know, the grand dam, literally, and she was running it. She never testified on her own defense. She was found guilty. There is no legitimate reason for, quote, making a deal with someone who has no reason. There's no reason to believe anything she says. Let's assume that she does, which she probably does, have some really remarkable information about some high prominent official, either Republican or Democrat, which is entirely possible. Why would we believe her? Because at this point, she's lied about everything, and the only reason that they would be doing this would be basically to make more deals. And I think many, many Americans are deeply, deeply suspicious of cases that where there's a trial and then a president or a governor steps in and says, oh, I'm going to pardon everybody. Now, Democrats have been grand masters at that, particularly here in Oregon and in other places. But Trump has been doing it, too. And I believe it's fundamentally wrong. We're not going to find out what happened.
Well, the only reason I put the criteria in there that it would have to lead to an indictment is that if she were to name five people and say these were five people who ended up with sex with children – you know, because I supply them or Jeffrey Epstein directed right. that I supply them, it would have to actually lead to an indictment. And her word alone would not be sufficient. There'd have to be other evidence before absolutely. You'd ever bring an indictment of those people, right?
And it's yes, absolutely. And it's very likely, considering that she's already been convicted of being not just incidental but a principal in it, that the judge might, as a matter of law in a federal case, and I have tried cases like this, rule that her testimony alone is insufficient and that basically the jury should disbelieve it. And even if the judge didn't tell them that, the jury probably would say, why should we believe a single word she says?
Yeah, because the defense attorney would stand up and say, you can't believe this woman. She lied for a living. She provided children to Jeffrey Epstein for sex. That is a conviction. I mean, we already know she did that. So therefore, let me ask you about another issue. And this is just now breaking. Although I have a feeling the mainstream media is going to have a tough time dealing with this one. There is a gay couple, and this gay couple decided that they wanted to have a child. This is two men, and they went online, and they did a crowdfunding to cover the costs of creating a surrogate child, which I think is problematic to begin with, as though you can go out and buy a child. You hire a woman, you have her implanted with sperm and egg and an embryo, and then you create a child and you own the child because you paid for it. I find all of that disgusting and
wrong.
Well,
nobody owns a child.
Except that when you can
you
go out and cause...
As the parents, you have control over
I understand that, but when you go out and as a result of you ordering up a child, you can commission a surrogate. Legal in
you're
most
right,
places.
Mars. Yeah, no, the idea of, you know, you want that somebody can say, oh, I want a particular race, I want a particular color, I want a particular, you know, sexual gender, and I want them to, you know, have, you know, it's we're getting into an area of eugenics, I think, that most of us find repellent.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Now, here's the thing. In most states, and I double-checked this morning, this is only being reported by Redux, which is a feminist website, and they're saying it turns out that one of the two men is a convicted sex offender and convicted of a serious enough offense that he's required to register as a sex offender. In Pennsylvania, wow. where this couple is, you can't adopt for all intents and purposes. And most states have regulations that while there's not an explicit ban on registered sex offenders adopting, sure. that they put you through a background check and say, no, we're not going to approve it. But there is
because
no such limit.
Has been shown to abuse children.
Yes. And now you've ordered up a child. Well, they crowdfunded this thing, and now it turns out one is a registered sex offender. According to the Chester County DA's office, they say this guy was teaching at a school. He convinced a student at the school who was about half his age, 16, to do various things for him, sent the kid nude pictures and did other disgusting stuff. Should there be a limitation on being able to order up a surrogate child if you're a registered sex offender?
Absolutely. I mean, people can get married or people can adopt, but when it is not the matter of a marriage or a traditional relationship, which in some circumstances could, I suppose, include gay couples, when you're talking about actually adopting, the state has a legitimate right to say, what's this person's background? And the idea that you would, and again, it really wouldn't matter whether this person had a sex offense for a gay crime or a heterosexual crime, I think society is legitimate in saying, I'm sorry, you have shown your gross irresponsibility that you don't care about children and then the fact that you're willing to ruin them. And so we're not going to sanction you by granting you a license, essentially, because that's what an adoption is.
That's what it is. It's a license to go out and adopt a child, and we're not going to give that license to people who are convicted sex offenders. Hey, Josh, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. There. Ronald Reagan knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. You can email talk@LarsLarson.com and find our daily poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Because I'm a conservative, please just vote once on the poll. We're not a Democrat show. In any case, I have the great pleasure of welcoming to the program Professor Emeritus David Beto, who is a professor emeritus in history at the University of Alabama. He's got a brand new book out about FDR. I have to admit, I always admit if I've got a bias, Professor, not a big fan of FDR for a lot of reasons, but you've written a book about him and the Bill of Rights. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I've written two books now. I on the strength of my other book, which was you interviewed me about a year and a half ago, something like that.
Yep.
The New Deal's War and the Bill of Rights. I got a contract and I did a full scale biography of FDR, and that's my new book, which is available now at Amazon. It's coming out officially on November 26th. We were trying to move that up, but anyway, you could still order it.
And at least that means that when people go Christmas shopping for their friends who love to read biographies and history like me, that they'll have something they can pick up that weekend or go on Amazon and get it. Tell me, is my skepticism about FDR well-placed or not?
I think it's very well-placed, and I've never been a particular fan of FDR. Even in childhood when I watched that movie, Sunrise at Campobello, there was something something untoward about FDR in my view. But then I did much more extensive research about him, and my estimation of FDR, which was not very high to begin with, has become much, much lower as I've looked into the various, you know, high points or low points of his administration. And that includes the entire sweep of his administration from when he took office in 1933 until his death in 1945. I would not rank him highly. In fact, in the last chapter, I describe him as a failed president. And I don't mean by that that he wasn't ineffective. FDR could be very effective if he wanted something. But that the policies that he chose, the methods he used, were... And it pushed the country very much in the wrong direction.
And does that push still exist to some extent today, that Americans are still under the yoke of a government that was set in a particular direction by FDR all those years ago, but is still going very much in that direction today? Can you see the echoes of it in what's going on today?
Oh, yeah, you can very much see it all over the place. The welfare warfare state, if you want to call it that, and civil liberties. I mean, I have my complaints about Trump and civil liberties, but FDR created a lot of the precedents for that, did a lot of the same things, had a lot of the same complaints. But the big difference between FDR and Trump is Trump will go out there like a bull in a china shop and threaten broadcasters with the FCC and fail, right? Jimmy Kimmel's back on, right? Because
yep.
he did
yep.
it in such a blundering way, in a way, obvious way. But FDR would do it quietly and he'd succeed. And by the late 1930s, there was not a single anti-FDR radio commentator left on the major networks. And FDR had accomplished that goal by quiet means, by going to sponsors, by using intermediaries, buffers, as they said in The Godfather. And he cleaned out all the opposition. But he did it quietly, and he did it quite effectively.
I'm talking to Professor David Beto, author of a brand new biography on FDR, second of two books about FDR. Please, if people are going to do something, no matter what that something is, they may be being a bigot. They may be discriminating. if they do it at least openly, at least the public knows what's going on and the public can react to it. As you said, when a president does it somewhat secretively and you just never know that it's happening, but it is happening, I consider the lack of transparency a real problem.
Yeah, and that's the whole story of FDR. Now, his style was, FDR rarely made personal attacks in public. He rarely personalized things. That's another difference with Trump, for good or ill, right? But he would do things behind the scenes. For example, I brought up the example of removing anti-FDR radio personalities. The leading one in the country in 1938 was a man named Bo Carter. Forgotten now, but was extremely popular. I believe it was CBS. He was on several times a day. He'd been supportive of FDR, but then he turns against him, was quite effective in criticizing him. FDR gave a speech and was asked about Carter, and he says, well, I've got more important things to do than to worry about him. Meanwhile, what was happening is he was putting pressure on people like Marjorie Merriweather Post, who founded Mar-a-Lago, interestingly enough. And she was a sponsor of Carter's show and using other methods to force Carter off the air. And at a dinner, he told this young guy who he thought he could trust all about this. And he says, we're looking everywhere. We're looking at his citizenship. We're looking at his taxes. And somehow we're going to get him off the air. And this guy was a young New Deal idealist who later wrote about this and said, I was shocked. This is a man I had so admired to hear him talking this way. So only after maybe getting a few drinks, talking to someone he thought he could trust, he'd open up. But he would never do that publicly.
No, and in fact, was he that insecure about his own ideas that he had to get rid of all criticism? Was that part of his personality or something else?
Oh, yeah, I'll give you a sense about how insecure he was. FDR was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War One, and there was a guy that had published a little newspaper, where he sort of implied, he said, well, we have everybody in uniform, but what about our Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who was in his late 30s, by the way, about the same age, I guess, as his relative, Teddy Roosevelt, was when he went and fought in the Spanish-American War, and implied there's something funny about this. Why isn't he in uniform? FDR was so mad about this that he wrote to the Assistant Attorney General in Atlanta and said, isn't there some way we can send this guy to jail? We can prosecute him. So he tried to have him prosecuted. But the guy wrote back and said, well, we just don't have, we don't have a case, right?
You can't put
even
somebody in jail for free
FDR
speech.
FDR is worse than Wilson. He's worse than Wilson on civil liberties. He wanted to prosecute this guy because he had criticized him.
I'm talking to David Beto, who is a professor emeritus in history at the University of Alabama. He has a brand new book, a full biography of FDR. We're going to talk more with Professor Beto in just a moment. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Be told, Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get to phone calls and emails in a bit. I'm talking to Professor Emeritus David Beto, who is a professor in history at the University of Alabama, emeritus, I should mention. He's got a brand new biography, the second of two books about FDR. you were about to talk about FDR, and we were talking about his insecurities. And it's one thing for people to have, everybody has insecurities. But when you're a public official and you act on those insecurities and, for example, try to get a radio guy thrown in jail because of your insecurities, that's a problem. But he was insecure as well about his disability?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. It's related to a scandal called the Newport sex scandal. And this is during World War One. FDR was Assistant Secretary of Navy, and he set up a squad in the Department of Navy called the Section A. And what their mission was to investigate the ranks to see if there was same-sex relationships, sexual relationships, and to purge those people from the Navy. He was very zealous about this. As a matter of fact, sent in investigators who entrapped people in same-sex relationships and had sex with them. So he actually presided over an investigation of people that would have gay sex to try to entrap people. And this is a time, of course, when, you know, people don't want gays in the military and so forth. But FDR's methods were so extreme, this method of entrapment, of destroying people, that he was investigated for this. It was a big scandal, and the U.S. Senate investigated him. And FDR wanted a chance to testify before the investigation, but they basically, I guess, just went ahead and came to their conclusions, which were that he was unfit for office. This is the Senate Investigative Committee. And he was so mad that he had not about this, that he had not been given the opportunity to investigate, that he, what happened shortly after that, only weeks after that, is he had his bout with polio, came down with polio. Of course, some debated whether it was polio or so, whatever. But, it was disabling, right?
Yep.
And it took him a long while to come back. But for the rest of his life, FDR blamed the Republican chair of that committee for the polio. And his argument was, and he actually might have been right about this, that all of the emotional pressure, all of the, tension created by this investigation had, lowered his resistance to getting polio.
Well,
and so he blamed the Senate committee for that. And he might have been right in a certain sense.
If he had been allowed to testify and had testified the way apparently he planned to testify, that his means and his methods were legitimate, would he have had much of a political career after that?
No, that's an interesting question. Would he have? I don't know. I don't think the testimony would have made any difference. Because FDR's initial reaction when people started making this accusation was, why are we so worried about this? Because isn't it important that we accomplish the goal? Why are we so worried about how we accomplish the goal? And then he later denied it, but nobody bought into it. But it came at kind of a good time for him in a way. The new administration was starting to appoint its cabinet and so forth, and the Democrats kind of united behind FDR, and it kind of just died away, and it was forgotten. And today it's forgotten, but historians that have looked at this have pretty much all agree with me that FDR was guilty of these methods. And you bring up that, to a pro FDR historian, many of them haven't heard of it.
They're not aware of it?
And then to the extent they have, they have no real defense of him on it.
Because even at the time, Professor, I'm talking to Professor David Beto, who's a professor emeritus in history at the University of Alabama, author of a brand new full biography on FDR that's coming out or will soon be out. But even at the time, that must have been a thoroughly controversial kind of thing to say, okay, you're going to investigate people for gay sex in the military, but you're going to send people in to have sex with those people so that you can establish this and then drum them out. I mean, even in those days, that would have been a scandalous thing, wouldn't it?
Very much a scandal. Very much. Now, I don't think FDR thought about it in those terms, though. I think his initial reaction was, what a great lift to my political career, right? That's just me thinking. He moved into this, right? He took charge of this investigation. There was a smaller investigation occurring, but they were running out of money. He stepped in. He took over leadership. He provided the funding. He made the investigation. And I think that he wasn't worried about that because he thought, well, you know, gays in the Navy, people are going to be on my side. They're going to want to drum them out. Perverts, right? Whatever. But that wasn't how it happened. And people reacted against this, that it was just going too far.
I'm talking to Professor David Beto, author of a brand new biography on FDR, second of two books about FDR. What else should people know, since we only have a limited time and I want people to go and read your book? What else should people know about FDR that perhaps they've never heard, even if they're a historian on FDR?
Oh, God, there's so much. One thing you could say about Japanese internment, we've all heard of that, but even historians who condemn Japanese internment, most of them do now, even they tend to pull their punches on FDR, I think unjustifiably. There was a lot of opposition to Japanese internment. That's not often talked about. And the initial reaction, even of California papers, was these are American citizens. He is excused, I think, wrongly on the basis that, well, you know, there was hysteria and he was distracted. His hand was on the tiller from the beginning. In fact, he wanted to intern Japanese Americans in Hawaii. He wanted to move them off to one of the small islands, which would have been a massive operation at the time. We're gearing up for Midway. But the commanders on the ground were basically able to kind of drag their feet and stop it by just bureaucratic foot-dragging.
Professor, there's one last thing I want to ask you about before we're going to have to wrap up, and then people should go pick up the book, and I'll do the same. I don't have my copy yet. But let me ask you about this. Jesse Owens goes and shows up Hitler at the Olympics. He comes back to America. It's routine for presidents to bring, you know, superstar athletes to the White House, and yet he was never invited. At least that's the way I understand the history. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, in fact, Owens mentioned this. He said, I think he said at one point, I could be wrong on this, I believe, but I think he said, you know, Hitler, didn't refuse to meet me, but FDR did, right? FDR's record on race was just extremely poor. Now, interestingly enough, Joe Lewis was a Republican and campaigned for the Republicans in 1940. So he was no big fan of FDR. And Owens as well, I've campaigned against FDR and when he ran for re-election. So it's interesting that, you know, he wasn't that highly regarded by some prominent African-American.
No doubt. Professor David Beto, and that's Beito. You can look it up, but find his book, brand new book on FDR, No Punches Pulled, and I'll encourage you to read it, and I'll be doing the same. Professor, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. We'll look forward to our next visit.
Wonderful. Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you very much. That is Professor David Beto, Professor Emeritus in History at the University of Alabama, author of a brand new book on FDR, full biography, and as you can tell, a lot of things you've never heard about one of the Democrat parties.
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. When I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. If you want to weigh in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. You can send emails. They come right to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. We asked you, should Americans be banned from buying junk food with food stamps? It's the suggestion of the new Donald Trump ag secretary, who has said we shouldn't let people buy junk food with EBT cards. 89% of you said yes, as did I. Only 21% of you said no, but it sounds like maybe Laura is in that 21% category. Laura, we always love naysayers. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of points I'd like to make.
Sure.
First of all, I just want you to know that I have been in the business of administering SNAP benefits for over 20 years now.
Okay.
And a couple of things. One, I was privileged to a report about 15 years ago that showed that for every dollar that is spent in the community, there's an almost $2 in economic growth. Because without you spending those benefits, we don't need as many clerks, as many trucks, as many products, and the list goes on.
Secondly, I'm trying to do the math on that one, Laura, because are we assuming that if you don't hand somebody EBT benefits, they're simply not going to buy food and eat?
They're definitely not going to buy food and eat as much, because if you don't have the money to buy the food, then you don't buy the food.
Then how does $1 turn into two?
You know, I can't give you all the details, but it had to do with the amount of businesses that are produced as a result of that extra millions of dollars going into the local economy.
Because here's what I looked at. I looked at the food stamp benefits for the United States are about 12.5% of the population, and SNAP is by definition a supplement. It is not supposed to be somebody's entire food budget. So if 12.5% of the population, instead of spending say $800 a month, they take the $400 they do have that's their own money, and they lose the $400 that is the EBT supplement to that budget, and they spend less. But is 12% of the population spending less, not spending zero? How in the world does that turn into a 1-2 gain for the system? If you give them the extra $400, somehow that turns into $800 worth of benefit to the system?
You know, I'm not entirely sure.
Because I'm not sure if you took the average grocery store and reduced their sales by 12%. I'm not sure how many clerks they'd fire. I suspect it's close to zero, unless you're a very small grocery store.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. But tell me this. How often did you see people work their way off of food stamps?
You know, you would be surprised. I can honestly say that I have probably interviewed several thousand people.
Okay.
And the ones that I think gain the most buzz from the world as a whole are the abusers. And they always get the most attention.
Probably.
But really, I cannot tell you the number of people I have across from me that are absolutely ashamed to have to be there. But here's the other point that I really wanted to make is I'm really concerned about who it is that gets to decide what's junk food. Because there are things like frozen pizzas and poor boys that are houseless populations who don't have access to a refrigerator count on being able to go in, make that one purchase, heat it up in the microwave, and be on their way.
So they have a microwave but no refrigerator. That's what you're saying.
They
have no house.
No, they have a microwave in the 7-Eleven.
I see.
So most of the people are cooking at a 7-Eleven or any one of these fast grocery stores, because that's the only way that they can heat up their food.
Well, let me ask you, I understand what you're saying, that if we define frozen pizza as junk food, I thought at the very beginning you say soda pop, potato chips, chewing gum, and candy, that's off the list. And we already have an example of that. Did you have any involvement in the so-called WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children?
Just in referring them.
Okay, but on the WIC list, is frozen pizza on the WIC list, or is the WIC list primarily bread, milk, meat, vegetables and things like that, because that's what you want a pregnant mom eating.
Correct.
So we already have a government agency that determines these are the wholesome foods and nothing else is on the list, right?
Right.
Do you trust them?
Boy, there's going to be a whole different set of groceries. I mean, WIC is very, very limited to just as few items.
Yeah.
We're talking millions of items. But the final point I wanted to make is, why should a person who's going through a hard time, why should they not be allowed to have a candy bar anymore?
Well, then they need to use their own money to buy the junk food, not the taxpayers' money. Laura, you're a good naysayer. Thank you for the call.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, federal judges are once again standing in the way of Donald Trump's agenda, at least until their decisions are taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court, where thankfully many of them are simply being overturned. But they've been tossing out executive orders, trying to contradict what the president does, as though they're in charge of the executive branch. I thought we'd talk about that with Zach Smith, who's a legal fellow with Heritage, co-author with Cully Stimson of the new book Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Zach, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Who's with every other political figure in America, the president can be elected, he can fail to re-election, he can be impeached, there are lots of consequences, but judges are insulated supposedly for a reason, but now we find out what happens when you give people this kind of power and say, and nobody can fire you.
Well, that's exactly right. And look, Lars, I'm just a simple country lawyer from down in the Florida Hills. So I just said, who judges the judges? That's the way I put it. And I think it depends whether we're talking about federal judges or whether we're talking about state judges. Now, at the federal level, you have many of these federal district court judges who, as you mentioned, have been issuing really egregious orders. And so we're seeing the Supreme Court starting to step in and slap some of those judges down, saying they got those decisions wrong, egregiously so in some cases. We're starting to see calls from Congress that they are going to step in. Chuck Grassley, Mike Lee, others have said they're going to step in and potentially change the jurisdiction of some of these courts, limit their ability to issue some of these injunctions. Those are good steps. Those are necessary conversations that need to happen. But what a lot of people don't realize is as many consequential decisions as federal court judges issue each and every day, even more consequential decisions are issued by state court judges each and every day. And in many cases, voters actually get to weigh in and elect those state court judges. And unfortunately, too often, voters don't participate in those elections. They don't understand who they're voting for, or what their judicial outlook is. And so it's very important that voters participate and understand in those state court elections when they have the opportunity to do so.
I got to tell you, Zach, I'm tempted to try and say, hey, I've got a homework assignment for you, but I'll make it as a soft suggestion. I want to know how often in America, because in my neck of the woods, there is a scam that goes on involving state court judges. And what they do is they're often appointed by a Democrat, and then they serve part of their term, and then they leave, not because of physical incapacity or, you know, some terrible tragedy in their lives. It's sort of like a there's an unspoken quid pro quo. A Democrat appoints me, and as long as there's a Democrat to appoint my successor, I will agree, without putting in a writing or saying it out loud, that I will quit in the middle of my term and then be, you know, replaced by somebody new, but somebody who's ideologically, you know, aligned. And the voters never get to have a choice, because in theory, those elected judges at the state level, they run as incumbents. And then a lawyer once explained to me, he said the reason nobody runs against him is to be a judge. In most states, you have to be a lawyer. You don't have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court, but you have to be a lawyer to be a judge at the state level. And I said, well, why don't any lawyers run against them? Because you'd have to be a well-established lawyer in that judge's jurisdiction. And if you run against him and lose, it's like that old advice about if you're going to kill the king, you got to kill the king. If you lose, you might as well pack up your shingle and move, you know, three states over, because your career is over. So almost nobody runs to challenge these jokers, and then they quit. Whatever one is sitting quits in the middle of his term, is reappointed by a new Democrat governor, and the voters never actually get to choose. I think that's part of the reason most voters ignore the judge elections, because they know it's already a fixed deal.
Well, and it's even worse than that in some sense, Lars, because even when the voters do get to weigh in, when they do get to have a say in it, oftentimes judges are very constricted in what they can say on the campaign trail. Often they're nonpartisan races. I mean, you don't have even that kind of ideological gut check of whether they're running as Republicans or Democrats or something else. So there are a host of problems with judicial elections as they currently exist. But look, they are vitally important. Look at what happened in Wisconsin just recently there, that state Supreme Court flipped from being a majority conservative to majority liberal Supreme Court because of a recent election. And just recently, that now liberal Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down Wisconsin's law banning abortions. State Supreme Court elections in particular are going to be important as more and more election law related issues come before them, as battles over redistricting come before them. And so these are elections that we have to pay attention to, that we have to focus on, because right now, certainly many on the left are gearing up and doing just that.
Okay, but Zach, what gives any federal judge the authority? For example, the Congress does not fund Planned Parenthood. They decide to leave it out of the funding bill. Now, funding or appropriation of money is done by the Congress. And then a judge says, well, they didn't fund it and I wanted funded. So he or she, I can't remember if it was he or she, but these days pronouns, who knows, says you have to fund it, as though the judiciary has something to say about the appropriation of money.
Yeah, it's an egregious overreach. And I think many of these judges have been getting out far over their skis. This was a particularly egregious decision. And unfortunately, Lars, what's going to have to happen, many of these cases are going to have to go back up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is really going to have to slap down these judges and say, no, we meant what we said before when judges do not have the authority to issue many of these types of injunctions. And look, at the end of the day, it's these types of egregious decisions that are undermining the confidence we should all be able to have in our federal judiciary.
So is there a way to fix, and should we perhaps, I mean, now that people are living a whole lot longer than they did when the federal judiciary was created, should we still have lifetime appointments to the federal bench?
Well, that's certainly a conversation that's happening. But look, I think right now, immediately, the Supreme Court needs to step in, make clear they're not going to tolerate this nonsense. And I do think Congress needs to have a serious discussion about potentially implementing jurisdictional restrictions on some of these judges, taking away some of the tools these judges have been abusing so egregiously. And those would be much simpler, much quicker, much more effective in some ways, conversations to begin having now.
Okay, and you think we could, I mean, could you say federal judges are allowed only to make decisions that operate within their districts?
You could potentially say that. They would have to operate with the respect to the parties before them, wherever those parties may be. But look, Congress has limited the jurisdiction of federal courts in the past. And frankly, Lars, I think the judiciary itself needs to do a better job of policing judges when they go so far afoul. Look, I'll be frank, Lars, I've never seen anything like some of these decisions where essentially the judges are ignoring orders directly on point from the U.S. Supreme Court. That is something that cannot be tolerated and cannot stand going forward.
Zach Smith is the author, along with Cully Stimson, of Rogue Prosecutors. Hey, Zach, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. Glad to have those calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first. You can email talk at LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find it at LarsLarson.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I love getting your emails, even the naysayer emails, talk at LarsLarson.com. And if you decide you want to set me straight, why, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Jessica is a naysayer who goes first. Jessica, if you listen to this show, you know we love naysayers. So welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. And what do we disagree about?
Hi, Lars, a long-time listener, first-time ever naysayer.
Wow.
I just
wow.
Don't be mean to me, Lars.
Okay.
I agree
I'll
with you
gentle.
So much of the time. But I really, drug testing people who need welfare, I just don't think that that's an American thing. I understand it for people who you might assume use that system, but what about the person who truly needs it and it is humiliated that they have to need it? Because really, you should be humiliated. I mean,
Hold on. Let me, for a clarification, are you humiliated because they find drugs in your system, or are you humiliated because you took the drug test and you came up clean? Which one is humiliating?
I mean, if I had to use that program and I was already, you know, embarrassed that I have to use that program and I really needed it, I would be humiliated that I have to go and pee in a cup and be tested for drugs.
Now, hold
That's
on, Jessica, you are aware that there are a lot of working Americans, men and women, who are routinely drug tested in their jobs, like commercial drivers, CDL licenses. And do you think they should be humiliated that we say we don't want somebody high on methamphetamine behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler?
No, because that involves other people's safety. I just think that's kind of different when it involves other people's safety. I just don't think also that it's very Christian of us when we are giving help to people who, you know, ideally actually need the help. There are definitely people who take advantage of the system, and I think there's many ways.
Let me ask a clarifying question. If you have to have somebody else help you buy your groceries, it may be because you're short of money. Most people, I wasn't born into wealth, you get money by working. If you've got drugs in your system, are you available to go and work most jobs in America?
I mean, I don't think so. And But I do think people do take advantage of the program. That's no doubt about it.
I know that, but that's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. Let's just stick with this. So you say, I need help buying groceries. And I say, okay, have you spent any money on drugs this week? And you said, yeah, I like to buy some weed. I got some methamphetamine, a little fentanyl for Friday night to have a party. And I say, if you've got money for drugs, why am I buying your groceries? Can you answer that one?
Right, no, that'd be absurd. Of course,
okay.
That'd be absurd.
So we want to drug test people to keep the people who are, number one, wasting their money on drugs and wasting themselves with drugs. We don't buy their groceries, so it's an incentive to get off the drugs. Number two, if they've got drugs in their system, that means they're not available for most jobs. Most jobs have a requirement that says you can't have drugs in your. Even the ones that don't do CDL tests, they say we don't want drug. We don't want a druggie working in a shop with the bandsaws or, you know, or drill presses or things like that. Bad idea. We don't want a guy who's on fentanyl while he's driving a forklift holding a ton of cargo up above the heads of his coworkers. So we're going to drug test you, and you don't have any choice. At that point, I would think the law-abiding person who's not taking drugs would say, fine, I'll show you that I'm clean. and then they get the benefit. And it's not embarrassing them. It's saying we need to make sure. And that person would appreciate, we don't want to give your grocery money to somebody who's got money to waste on drugs, who's wasted on drugs, who isn't out trying to work and improve himself or herself. And that's why we're doing it. Is that unreasonable to do that?
I mean, I see that argument, but I guess I'm just naive, and I wish that that wasn't something that had to be done. I don't know how prevalent it is that
I already know the answer to this question, but Jessica, do you have any friends who are unrepentant drug users?
Maybe not friends, but I've definitely known people, and and I do have a family member. So,
but at that point, if you give them an incentive to get off the drugs, is that positive for their life?
Oh, definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
Now hold on. Now let's take the other side of that one. If you say to them, even if you like to get high and you spend a bunch of money on drugs, we're glad to buy your groceries. Have you just incentivized them to stay on the drugs?
Yeah, definitely. I guess I just
do you
like
want
to
do
think
that
there's not as many people. No, I don't. I just like to think that there's not as many people who are drug addicts that are using that system.
Well, hold on, Jessica. Last year, more than 100,000 people overdosed on fentanyl alone. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's not counting the methamphetamine folks, the heroin folks, just fentanyl. Over 100,000 people died from it last year. That means to get that many deaths, you have to have a gigantic number of people who are routinely using what we call hard drugs. Not pot, but we're talking about cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, fentanyl, things like that. So there are a lot of people out there who are affected by drug addiction. And if we say, we're happy to buy your groceries while you're addicted, to me, I've told the story before, my dad was an unrepentant alcoholic. He's long since passed away. As an adult, I never would have bought him booze, period. And even if you said, oh, I could really use a drink, I'm not buying you booze. You're an addict. I won't participate in it. If you're one of those, right. And Jessica, do you smoke cigarettes?
No.
Do you have any friends who do?
My stepmom does. Yeah.
Okay. And if your stepmom said, hey, pick me up a carton of smokes, would you say,
no,
I'd be
would.
Happy to, huh?
No, but, well, is there
no,
a problem
and because
with,
you say, I don't want any part of that, right?
Right.
You can smoke
right.
if you want to. I'm not going to stop you, but I won't be part of it. Well, to me, a system that says we're going to give you free health insurance, Medicaid. We're going to give you free groceries, SNAP. We're going to give you free housing, Section 8. We're going to give you all these other, and TANF, welfare, what they used to call welfare, now they fancied up with the name of TANF. They said, we're going to give you all these free stuff, and we know you're a drug addict. So we know that any cash you manage to get by selling your food stamp benefits, by making other kinds of side deals, by taking your TANF and spending it on methamphetamine or heroin instead of spending it on your kids and your family, we're happy to help you out with that. Jessica, can you tell me morally where we are as a country if we say we're happy to give you the resources so you can keep on taking drugs that will probably eventually take your life in a really horrible way? Where are you morally
right.
Well, of course
if you I don't do that? Agree with that. That's definitely a good point. But do we have a problem with drug addicts taking advantage of these particular systems?
And I thought I would get to that, but I'd ask it to you this way. So this person who regularly and routinely is addicted to hard drugs, what do you suppose their day job is?
Well, of course they don't have one, but are they on
okay,
Tuesday?
hold on. Then where are they living? How are they housing themselves?
Okay.
How are they feeding themselves? And what happens when they OD? Who pays the bill? Well, we're paying for all that. So when you say, gee, I wonder if this person who isn't working and is spending hundreds of dollars on illegal drugs, I wonder where they're getting that money. And sadly, Jessica, they're getting it from us. And if they don't get it through the social welfare programs, they get it by stealing from us. And that's one more harm. But Jessica, you are a great naysayer. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's.
So
sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, to paraphrase a politician from days long, long ago, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. And just a moment ago, I was talking about the fact that ODOT made a billion-dollar boo-boo by overestimating its revenue coming in. Kind of like if you wrote in twice as much money into your checking account as you actually get from your paycheck, and then you just spent on the basis that you had twice as much money. They made that kind of billion-dollar mistake. Well, there's another billion-dollar mistake that they're attempting to pawn off on the public, and this one involves the biggest public works project in the Northwest right now, and that is the replacement of the interstate bridge over the Columbia River from Oregon to Washington on Interstate 5. And John Lee is the guy, state representative and retired pilot, who actually spotted this attempted scam. John, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on. But yes, there's so many things happening in the world of transportation here that happy to run down several of these things for you and your listeners.
Well, let's talk about this, because you and I have talked about the fact that they want to add 2 miles of light rail that will run from the Expo Center in Oregon on the Oregon side over to 0.9 miles into the state of Washington. And we've said it's $2 billion and it's 2 miles. So it's $1 billion a mile. And yet there's an attempt to try to say that this does not add $2 billion of cost to the interstate bridge.
Well, they're constantly playing games with this. And there was an interesting public records request that I got where the program told the Federal Transit Administration that to build the actual bridge component of it, that cost was $1 billion, $1.021 billion, which is amazing in and of itself. So they're talking a $7.5 billion project, and only $1 billion of it is the bridge. Subtle hint number one, they're burying and hiding lots of ridiculous things in it. A different aspect of that was that the transit component of that, they said, was 16%, or roughly $166 million. And so, again, that shows, I believe, the cost of the tracks and things that are being laid in it. But they don't go into details. But so much of this is smoke and mirrors, where they're hiding money. But at the end of the day, they're asking the federal government to pony up half of the $2 billion transit component of this $7.5 billion project. And it makes no sense for any of us to ask our taxpayers, either at the state or the federal level, to pony up this kind of money, because nobody is riding mass transit anymore.
No, well, and when you say nobody, the numbers are down dramatically. They've had declining numbers in Seattle. They've had declining numbers in Portland on TriMet. And you've pointed out before that Clark Transit, has had a very small number of people riding their express buses, which follow the same path as the light rail is going to follow. And they're saying that's, what, 500 people a day, and they say they're going to boost that to tens of thousands?
Yeah, exactly right. Greg Johnson and his team are projecting 26 to 33,000 people or boardings on every day just on the I-5 corridor. And currently you're seeing about 500 boardings, which, assuming a person boards twice a day, that's 250 people that are no longer riding their cars or whatnot. It's ridiculous to spend potentially $2 billion for that kind of a massive light rail project in search of a bridge.
Okay, and in terms of hiding the money, John, I just want to make sure I understand this right. They only want to count the tracks and other light rail garbage that they put on the bridge itself, but not the tracks that come to the bridge or the tracks that go from the bridge into Vancouver. So they want to say, oh, those don't count because they're not actually part of the bridge?
Well, and so this is an interesting discussion, in that they're asking the Federal Transit Administration to let them spend money, and they can't spend the money for the other components of that for a couple years. In a sense, you have certain metrics you have to cross, and they haven't crossed those metrics, so they can't spend the money to buy the light rail vehicles, to do the expansion of the transit station at Expo, or build the transit station in Vancouver, or the transit station 80 to 90 feet above the ground. So what they are asking permission for is for just in designing the bridge, can you let us spend some of the money for the design of the bridge portion only right now, and then they'll ask for the rest of it later. It gets very convoluted.
Well, and here's the thing, John. ODOT is broke right now. They're so broke, they're telling folks, well, we're going to lay off 600 people now. We may lay off hundreds more next year. We're out of money. We can't plow snow. We can't help out with fire evacuation. We can't do any of that stuff. Don't expect any of it. But they're going to have what? Their component, their half of maybe $4 billion. So ODOT is going to somehow come up with $2 billion, and they're flat bust right now.
Yeah, there is so much wrong in this. The Oregon legislature, even though they didn't pass the transportation package, which you noted was the largest transportation tax increase in the history of Oregon, even though they didn't pass that, they did allocate $250 million out of the general fund that could have spent on any number of things that Oregon citizens really want, but they allocated that $250 million for the IBR to keep Greg Johnson afloat and keep this
now. Hold on, so John,
alive.
Do I understand this right? They took money they could have spent on regular day to day operations of ODOT, which is the entire highway system that serves 90,000 square miles of Oregon, and they parked it over in an account to be spent on a bridge that I think you and I have both discussed is probably a dead project right now. Because of federal funding, because of Coast Guard approval, because of opposition to light rail and everything else, but they parked the money where ODOT can't use it for the day-to-day needs of citizens, but will have it there for a bridge that may never actually be built?
Exactly right. And that was unbelievable, and I think serves the Oregon citizens so, so poorly.
By the way, John, you know that I try to do my due diligence. I mean, sometimes I succeed and sometimes I don't. But I sent notes to IBR. I said, I want to talk to Greg Johnson. I've got some questions for him. And they said, Mr. Johnson will not agree to an interview. He will, however, take your written questions. And the problem with written questions is, and I've done this before, I don't submit questions in advance because then the person you're seeking to interview just simply says, well, I'm not going to answer those. Or they answer them in the way they want to, which would require a follow-up, only you can't follow up in a text, you know, Q&A. So, you know, the end result is Johnson doesn't want to talk about this. And I think it's because he's got a big, fat job with a big, fat six-figure paycheck on a project that is already a dead man walking, and he doesn't want to talk about it because he doesn't have answers for all this. Would you find any fault with that argument?
Not at all. And a different aspect of this was that because Oregon didn't pass their transportation package, TriMet didn't get their huge statewide payroll tax increase. They were seeking that 200% increase in the head tax.
Yep.
They didn't get that, and they're threatening to cut 10% of their light rail service as well as 27% of their bus service. Well, that is a not-so-subtle hint that there is no demand. They can't even afford to maintain their current service.
Doesn't make any sense, does it? That's John Lee, state representative, retired airline pilot, and a reporter for Clark County Today. Back in a moment.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list.
Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm always tempted by a naysayer, so I thought I'd go to Doug. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program. If you've listened for a while, you know that we love naysayers. So thanks for making the call. And what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer today?
I agree mostly with what you say. I'm a frequent listener, but I can't all the time. But on the issue you're discussing today about ag workers, I would have to vehemently disagree. We hire up many people with the H-2A program. We are mandated to require not only to pay almost $20 an hour for those workers, we are obligated under the program that if any American citizen wants to come, they can get exactly the same wages. We are losing money in the apple industry hand over fist, and what we are facing now is an H-2A program that becomes increasingly complicated every single year. And this program, when we talk about...
And by the way, for everybody listening, correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, H-2A means you're bringing in foreign nationals to do the work, but you have to officially offer it to Americans first. And only when you can't find enough Americans to do the job, then you're allowed to offer it to foreign nationals to come in and work under the H-2A program, correct?
Even beyond that, if they drive up in a car and you've already hired your H-2A workers, you are required to hire them at the same wages.
Now, would you be surprised at all, Doug, that I hear from Americans all the time who say, I've gone out, my kids have gone out, we have tried to get the jobs, and even though it is an H-2A farm, we are turned away, that there is not much enforcement of that rule?
I would find that very difficult to believe. We are many times can't bring enough workers in. With the state of Washington now, we are required to only work them for 40 hours. In harvest, everyone else is working 50 and 60 hours just to get the apples picked.
Yep.
And it's a standing with signs outside that workers are needed. And when someone comes by, they'll come and pick maybe one or two bins of apples, which isn't even worth tying up tractor ladders and bins to try to get the job done.
I understand the problem, how long is it going to be before, because I'm amazed at how fast automation has gone in, even in the last 10 years, has moved into American farming, and it seems to be replacing all those jobs. So what do you do when those H-2As, who sometimes overstay their visas, they may work an H-2A job to begin with, but overstays are one of the biggest problems. What do you do when those people say, I don't want to go home, I want to stay here, so I'll go do sheetrock work or concrete work and those jobs, and they're taking the jobs of Americans? How do you fix that?
That has really nothing to do with the H-2A program. We document and make arrangements for them to get home, and they are required. And if there was any enforcement that can be required, that can be on that end. There are very, very few that disappear. I can count them on one hand over the last 5 years that disappear without completing their
program. I'm saying if they complete the work for you and then they leave your farm and say, I'm headed home, you don't know whether they go home or not, do you?
We don't know if they go home.
Right.
That's really not our issue.
I know. It's not your problem. Doug, if you're saying it's not your problem, then how do we solve the problem that visa overstays of all kinds are one of the biggest problems? I mean, it was very visual when Joe Biden let 10 million flood across the border and stay. But it's also a problem that numerically visa overstays are a gigantic problem.
When they come in, we have to hire buses to bring them up from the border all the way here. If there was a requirement that we hired buses and took them back to the border and let them loose, that would solve that problem in a very simple step.
It'd solve the problem of getting them to the border, but you don't know. And why do you think a lot of these people came originally, even decades ago, for the ag jobs? And when it got to the end of the ag season, and they say, there are jobs here I could do where I could make 10 times what I make back at home, so I'm going to stay.
They're not really part of our ag program. That's no different than someone sneaking across the border. Most of the people that are working here don't want to be here full-time. As we visit with them, what they want to do is earn what they consider a tremendous amount of money, go home and live like a king until the next time they come back.
And I get that idea, but Doug, do you know, what would you say you pay your average foreign national worker who works for you in a month?
It costs in a month?
Yeah, a month.
They're allowed 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
You have to pay them right at $20 an hour.
So you're paying them about $3,000 a month.
When you add,
right?
When you add additional onto that, it works out to about $25 that covers their free housing.
I get that, but no, you're not getting my point. If you're paying them $3,000 a month and they're going to go back, the average ag worker job in Mexico is $200 a month. Now, you're telling me that at the end of harvest here, they say, I'll go back to Mexico or I'm going to make $200 a month instead of $3,000 a month I could make here.
That's probably what the lure is, but this is with an existing program that with a tiny tweak, we can ensure that they get back across the border. And then the problem is no different than just someone sneaking across whenever they want to.
That's a very good point. Doug Goodnase here. Thanks a lot for the call. Back in a moment, we'll get to your phone calls and emails. And glad to take those calls at 866-HEY-LARS.
The Lars Larson Show.